Good morning, counsel. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is back in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Ross, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Morning, counsel. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are here for our second case on the calendar today, June 22nd, 2021. That is A210162 Ringsred versus Duluth Economic Development Authority. Counsel, I am going to ask that you mute your microphone if you're not speaking. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. If I didn't say to identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking, I'm saying it now, or I've said it twice. I can't remember. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. Please keep an eye on that. With that, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I'm Elizabeth Sellers. I'm an assistant city attorney in the Duluth City Attorney's Office, and I represent the appellants in this matter. They're the City of Duluth and the Duluth Economic Development Authority, which I'll refer to as DETA. DETA is the owner of the property that's at the heart of this case. And I'd like to take just a minute briefly to give an overview of how we got where we are today with the property and what it is that we're asking this court to afford us in relief. The property is an historic downtown Duluth structure that's been blighted for a decade or more. In 2006, respondent Ringsred entered a contract for a deed for the property. At that point, what was originally 6 luxury townhomes from the 1880s had been converted into as many as 50 single-room occupancy units. There was a bar in the front of it. It was described at trial as a problem property with problem tenants, a magnet for crime. And in 2010, while Ringsred controlled the property, it suffered a major fire. And it's been condemned for human habitation at all times since then. Ringsred stopped paying property taxes and the title passed to the state through tax forfeiture. And DETA bought the property in that process in order to mitigate blight. DETA acquired the property out of concern for the public welfare. And in order to turn that corner of downtown Duluth around. And knowing full well that the property is of some historic significance, it's listed as a contributing structure in the National Register, DETA worked to find a development partner who could rehabilitate the structure. And the efforts that DETA went to were detailed in a bench trial in this case in the spring of 2019. They're summarized again in our briefing here. But it was years of effort to try to find a suitable partner who could restore the historic buildings. And DETA came up empty-handed. Nobody was interested in acquiring or partnering or any other way could present a plan that would actually result in historic rehabilitation. And so determining that it had reached the end of the road, DETA applied for demolition contracts. And at that point...
Counsel, if I may, because I think we're all familiar with the facts in this case, and as you know, it's been before us before, but I understand you're saying that it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to refuse to dissolve the temporary restraining order, correct? I mean, that's one of your central arguments.
Yes.
And
yes.
Could I just kind of cut to the chase and say, how could it be an abuse of discretion because weren't there where there were disputed facts about the possibility, maybe a remote possibility, but the possibility of historic preservation? So could you help me with that?
For two reasons. And we're here now after a significant change of facts following an additional major fire in the fall of 2020.
I understand that, so, but aren't the facts even after the fire, weren't there disputed facts about the possibility, even if it was expensive, of some type of historic preservation?
No, and for two reasons. The first has to do with the historic preservation aspect, and the second has to do with the structural possibility aspect, so structural engineering. So as to the historic preservation aspect, the condition of the property is summarized in findings by the architecture and engineering firm LHB. There's no dispute as to the accuracy of the findings laid out in that post-2020 fire report by LHB. And what that report shows is a collapsed roof of the historic townhomes on the First Street side, failed brick sections, sections of brick that are will need to be replaced with new brick if they're saved at all. And the question that Judge Hill then below asked is whether it's even possible to save, for example, just the First Street facing facade. And what we know about historic rehabilitation, what we learned from plaintiff's key expert witness on this aspect at the trial in 2019, is that there are restrictions on what counts as historic preservation, historic rehabilitation. And that witness, Michael Conlin, clearly
Counsel, I did not see in Mr. Conlin's testimony where he talked about this particular building not being subject to historic preservation. What I saw was on page 58 of the testimony that he was responding to the court's question about the Passeret Stenson building and the I can't pronounce the word, facadectomy, and the reduction of the size of the building from 6 stories to 3 stories. But he wasn't talking about the building that's at issue in this case. So can you point to me in the record where there's some testimony about the inability to preserve the historical nature of the building, of this building?
Mr. Conlin testified at trial as to this building that the State Historic Preservation Office, SHPO, would only approve replacing exterior brick with new brick if that exterior brick was not visible from the street. And that I don't have an exact line citation, but I believe that's in the same passage that's included in our addendum.
So then why is it that the district court's phased approach in response to the motion to quash the TRO is an abuse of discretion? Because perhaps during the phased approach, there's some possibility that the historic nature of the building could be preserved on an ongoing, on a going forward basis.
The phased approach starts with, and I'm speaking to the historic rehabilitation aspect first, the phased approach starts with looking at that First Street facade. And there we know the upper regions of the brick on that First Street facade are going to need to be replaced with new brick, contrary to what SHPO has said would count as historic rehabilitation. Second, as to the structural aspects, the district court's decision ordering us to brace just the outside of the facade and do nothing with the failed interior is an abuse of discretion because it's contrary to what's possible, physically possible for this structure.
But didn't Mr. Berry's affidavit in paragraph 5 state that the restoration of the structural integrity of the building was possible?
He did say that. His affidavit is based on his reading of the LHB's summary of the physical condition. LHB, who actually inspected, who actually saw the property and saw the condition that it's in, said, and we've submitted affidavits from LHB's principal engineer and from the construction manager at Krauss Anderson, who would implement the LHB plans. Those affidavits clearly state that in order physically to brace the facade, you need first to remove the failed interior structure, all of the debris that's weighing on the facade.
Ms. Sellers, experts often disagree on things. Are you saying Mr. Berry shouldn't have been qualified as an expert? Did you object to that at the district court level?
No, but Mr. Berry also clearly in his affidavit agrees that the failed debris is a structural problem for this for this structure.
But isn't there a difference between a structural problem and, you know, the possibility and saying it's impossible to have historic preservation?
And that's why those are two separate arguments, that historic rehabilitation is out of reach based on what Michael Conlon, Mr. Conlon, testified at trial, what he testified that historic rehabilitation means. And the order in which Judge Hilden has asked us to proceed is a physical structural impossibility. And so for those two reasons.
Well, according to Mr. Berry, it's not an impossibility. He says it's possible. And then in paragraph six, he explains how to, of his affidavit, he explains how to accomplish the restoration of the property to preserve its structural integrity. So what I'm hearing from you, counsel, is that you're claiming there's an abuse of discretion because the district court, at least at this preliminary phased approach, is crediting the testimony of Mr. Berry. Is that right?
Crediting not only perhaps the testimony from the affidavit submitted in the briefing process, perhaps a letter summarizing Mr. Berry's views that was submitted after the January 4th hearing.
So how is that an abuse of discretion? I mean, our case law typically states that the district court is in the best position to make those credibility determinations. And as long as it's supportable by the record and not contrary to the weight of the evidence, we would defer to those determinations as within the discretion of the district court. Is there some case law to the contrary that we should be looking at this through a different lens?
I agree that much lies in the district court's discretion. And I return to the aspect of historic rehabilitation where there is nothing in front of the district court and nothing in the record that contradicts Mr. Conlon's testimony about the parameters of what that entails. I'd like, if I may, to turn to the issue of the security for any temporary injunctive relief. And here there's a clear abuse of discretion in that the district court did not even address the topic. So ordinarily, when a district court orders temporary injunctive relief, the district court must require the party in whose favor the relief is ordered to post the security sufficient to indemnify the party that's being required to act under that injunction.
Ms. Sellers, can we just clarify, your claim is that the district court erred in failing to consider the request for a bond with respect to the amended TRO to implement the phased approach. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And any work according to that temporary injunctive relief to preserve the facade or otherwise protect the buildings from impairment or destruction. That's the language of MIRA, to protect against impairment or destruction. And any steps that DITA or the city will be required to take are going to be an extremely expensive measure, extremely expensive measures using public funds.
And is it your position that the district court, if we remanded this matter to the district court to consider the request for a bond, is it your position that the district court must impose a bond, or does the district court have the discretion to make a determination that a bond is not appropriate in these circumstances?
Based on the rules and the cases in MIRA, it is our position, and we cited those in our brief, it's our position that the district court must require the posting of a bond. And that's a combination of the Rule 65, MIRA is 116B.07, both contemplate posting of a bond, and reading those rules together, this court has said that a bond is required in the context of temporary injunctive relief under MIRA.
Ms. Sellers, if I can follow up on the bond issue, could you please address respondents' argument, which in part, as I understand it, is, look, if there was going to be an appeal from the lack of a bond, it really should have been at 60 days after the district court's October 6, 2020 order restoring the temporary injunction. And you clearly didn't appeal that, and there was no bond required then.
We did not appeal then. That injunction was merely to prevent DITA from demolishing the structures. That order did not require any affirmative steps to protect the property. So there was no order for bracing of a facade, no order for new roof, you know, nothing, no affirmative steps to take. So the order that we are appealing is the January 2021 order requiring expenditure of at least tens, likely hundreds of thousands of public funds for very uncertain results. It's uncertain that MIRA's goals can be accomplished. It's uncertain that any sort of structural rehabilitation can be accomplished. And that's a risk that the public should not have to bear without some security in the event that that relief is ultimately found to be wrongly entered. For those reasons, we respectfully request the court to remand to the district court with instructions to proceed consistent with the Court of Appeals decision.
All right, thank you, Ms. Sellers. Mr. Ringsred, just a moment, we'll reset the clock here for you. Go ahead, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Miles Ringsred. I represent the respondents in this case. And while the scope of the legal questions being appealed today are pretty narrow, the scope of the underlying issues, as you are well aware, are fairly deep and broad. This has been going on for the last several years. And if you consider a number of the other facts, we can go all the way back to 2010. But you all seem very familiar with this, so I'll spare you at this point. And I'll just go into a couple of the issues that have already been identified.
Can I ask you to start in reverse order and address first the district court's failure to respond to the bond request?
Certainly. The appellates rely on BioLine Inc., in which they state that a district court not detailing its reasons why it is waiving a security bond to be placed for an injunction, that that is an abuse of discretion. As we briefed extensively, the BioLine case could hardly be any...
I'm going to go, before you get into the substance, just the court's failure to address the issue. Why is that not an abuse of discretion?
Because it did. As we got the transcripts, you'd be able to read the transcripts from the hearing in which this issue was briefed by both parties, and we held oral arguments for it. And from the district court was my hands are tied. It had just gotten a mandate from this court, essentially ordering the district court to reinstate the injunction and ordering the appellants to begin necessary repairs and maintenance to prevent deterioration. It acquired this property back in 2016, and it, in a report from the county before it purchased it, indicated that if no remedial measures were taken, that deterioration would begin exponentially. And even to this day, it has failed to put a dime into any.
My question is, I thought you were going to express or identify where in the record the court did address the question of bond. Can you either by citing to the written order or transcript, can you identify or quote for us where the court, what the court said when the court addressed the issue of the bond?
I don't have an exact line, but it was in the transcript for the hearing, I believe January 6th, in which the appellate's motion to lift the injunction and respondent's motion to enforce appellate court order was held during those oral arguments.
Although you can't cite the location, maybe you, can you paraphrase for us as closely as you can recall what the court said in addressing the question of bond?
That his hands were tied, and wouldn't the Court of Appeals be mad if I didn't put an injunction in place and didn't require them to move forward with the remedial measures that was mandated by this court?
I'm not talking about the imposition of the injunction. I'm talking specifically about security. Those are two separate issues. whether you know, the extent of the injunctive relief and whether there's security. So what is the language where the court addresses the question of security?
Again, I don't have the exact, I'm paraphrasing again, but it was sort of implicit in that whole, in his whole saying that he had his hands tied if he, if we.
I think the problem, counsel, is that there was an affirmative request that the court say yes or no, or set a number on a bond. And although the court may have made some statements during the hearing, there's no decision from the court as to the question that was presented to it. So when there's no decision, so when the court, the district court is presented with a request, a motion, and there's no response to that motion, why isn't it an abuse of discretion for the district court to fail to give a yay or a nay on the request?
So again, going back to the BioLine case then, where it's essentially the questions at this point, at least from respondents' perspective, is it a bright line rule that in every case, no matter the circumstances, that a district court is required to detail in its opinion that its reasoning behind not requiring an injunction bond?
But the district court didn't make a decision that an injunction bond wasn't required. It just didn't answer the question. So I agree with you that BioLine doesn't really come into play yet because there's no decision.
So one of the arguments that was made that the we believe that the judge reiterated at oral arguments was the tricky situation if the respondents weren't able to come up with a bond, then it would be violating the appellate court order. There's no way that we could, then an injunction could be set in place. The appellate court ruling that all these remedial measures need to take place would essentially possibly raise the cost of the bond. There was all sorts of issues that were discussed during that oral argument that gives this court, in our perspective, enough to review the decision to not require a bond. His absence of him saying that there would be a bond or ordering a bond to be placed is his affirmative answer that no, there is no bond that needs to be put forward with this.
Counsel, can I have you address Ms. Sellers' argument that there is nothing in the record, in particular from Mr. Conlin's testimony, that would support any finding that with respect to the historical nature of the building?
So the first issue about that is really twofold. First, they're saying that it's impossible to protect, and second, that it's that whatever measures would need to be taken to preserve this property, take it out of the historical category. Mr. Conlin's testimony was, as you noted, a response to the court's question, which was really more philosophical than it was legal, in terms of, okay, would it be a historic building if I built the Taj Mahal in Duluth brick by brick? Would it be historical preservation if we tore a historic building down, took those bricks, and rebuilt it elsewhere? So it was really a kind of, could we tear it down and just rebuild it? Could you rebuild it with new bricks? So it was really very philosophical questions there. And Michael Conlin's testimony was all centered on the property as it currently was before the November 1st fire, and mostly with respect to the historic preservation tax credit application, which the project had received, which was approved by the Federal Department of Interior and the State Historic Society for historical preservation tax credits. And so it's really disingenuous to say that that Conlin's testimony in any way, shape, or form is decisive in terms of what is possible going forward.
Well, what about the argument that the record shows that the SHPO will not approve of the use of new bricks to maintain the historical nature of the building. And that's the only way that this property can be restored, by the use of new bricks.
Well, first I would say, when it comes to what measures need to be taken, I would say that is disputed. LHB did go and do an initial assessment, but they even admit that they weren't able to get in and do a really close inspection because of some of the conditions of the property. So there are a number of disputes in terms of whether some of that stuff needs to be done or the extent of what needs to be done. And with respect to Michael Conlon's testimony about that, that I think is misstating the testimony. He's not necessarily a historic preservation expert. I mean, he has extremely high credentials in terms of economic development and submitted the application for historic preservation tax credits. However, SHPO didn't testify. He may not have actually recalled, and that's not exactly correct. Ultimately, what would have to do, what they are saying is that this property is no longer a contributing structure to the historic district in downtown Duluth. And another litmus test for that would be if this property, a developer tried to obtain historic preservation tax credits, if those design plans would be rejected by the Department of Interior or the State Preservation Office, because the redevelopment design plans would require reassembly of bricks. But again, it's all a question of fact. How much of the brick needs to be removed? Can those bricks be removed and put back into place? These are all the questions that we're still yet to determine.
And it's my understanding that the reason for the phased approach originated with the issues with respect to the structural integrity of the building, not necessarily with respect to the historic nature of the building. Is that right?
Yeah, it was really an approach based off of appellate's reports, based off of our expert testimony or our expert structural engineer, where essentially the idea is to prevent the facade from falling out when really the collapsed roof structure, that needs to be taken out to stop the stress on any other parts of the building. So to do that, you would put a brace on the outside, you would remove those parts from it. And the phased approach was basically, let's prevent it from falling outwards and injuring the public or doing anything like that. So we can start there. Then once things are secure, as I mentioned before, we can get people in and do a closer inspection because they weren't able to do one. We still haven't had a very close inspection to be able to make a lot of these determinations even at this point. And so the phased approach was just taking all of this information that we had at the time and figuring out what made the most sense in terms of moving us forward. If we finished the first phase and we determined, hey, we get some input from SHPO or the Department of Interior, hey, preservation's not going to happen, you guys, then we can, without expending more of the public funds, we're just still at phase one. We don't have to go all out. We thought that a phased approach was the most practical and prudent way to go forward. And then just to note, there's also the attached Robeson ballroom, which has really gone undiscussed in this whole process. It's a completely separate building. It wasn't damaged by the smoke or fire from the first fire in 2010, wasn't touched or damaged by the second fire in November 1st, 2020. And that's a completely separate property. And they are proposing to just tear down this whole lot. And so while they are focusing on, and the focus really has been on the pastorate, that's really another big factor that they have not been able to address. Are there any further questions?
Anything else from the panel?
I'd just like to close quickly and just say that this has been going on for a number of years. We believe that the appellants have really been fairly bad actors. They took a property away from a developer. And Mike Conlon, who has credentials, very high credentials, from the previous owner who, between the first fire and when it went tax forfeit, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars securing the property from the elements, trying to get the property back up and running, and in a very, very extensive development project. They took it away against state and policies of giving the property back and haven't put a dime into it since 2016, even knowing that the property would deteriorate exponentially. And really at this point, after the court, it has already been to the court and they've been told that they need to start protecting this property. They've been dragging their feet. It's been a game of delay, delay, delay. And they knew very well that people were getting into the properties, didn't put up any security measures, simple security system to notify if trespassers were getting in there to prevent a fire. It was really just a matter of time, knowing how much trespassing was actually going on. And so respondents respectfully ask this court to uphold the district court's order, allow this property to get the attention that it deserves, and not allow appellants to benefit from their own neglect.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you very much. Ms. Sellers.
Just briefly, I'd like to respond to a few of Mr. Ringsred's remarks, especially at the end of his argument there. It's blatantly false to say that Deed and the City have put not a dime into these structures. The record is replete with examples of constantly reboarding, refencing, and protecting the property, clearing private waste, clearing solid waste, clearing graffiti, and maintaining the structures within reasonable use of public funds. Second, the process by which DETA acquired the properties is not at issue in this case. It's already resolved in a different litigation. Looking specifically at the facts relevant to the instant appeal, there may be unknowns, there are unknowns about the structural condition of the property following the 2020 fire, but there's no dispute about what LHB engineers were able to observe and what they were able to document. That's where any work under Judge Hilden's January 2021 order would start. And what we know, what we agree there, is the failed condition of bricks in the facade and facing the first street. Looking at what we know from the trial and Mr. Conlon's testimony, replacing that brick takes us out of what SHPA would consider historic rehabilitation. Finally, Judge Ross is correct in observing that Judge Hilden simply didn't address the issue of a security, and that alone is a reversible abuse of discretion. So unless the court has further questions, appellants respectfully seek reversal and remand for further proceedings.
All right, anything else from the panel? All right, thank you very much, counsel. Your arguments and submissions were very helpful today. The matter is submitted and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time period.
All right, thank you very much.